Excuse me, if we can ask everybody to take their seats, we're going to go ahead and get started. Thanks.
Oh, well, good morning again. Welcome to this panel on learning. I think there's no area of internet-related ambition that has had more optimism associated with it than learning. This is particularly so because if we're talking about development across divides, one vision of that is simple access. But another, and I believe a sounder vision, is that real development across divides must be premised on the objective of developing indigenous capacity to control the technology. And so that means learning. Now, also associated with learning is a big question mark, because every new medium as it's come in, radio, television, has heralded a new era of education through the medium, which has great promise to begin with, but then falters, apparently, as it goes. And that may again be the case with internet. The hope is that there is so much richness in the medium, so much opportunity for interactivity, that one can actually break through the barrier to create real educational environments using it. So what we've done this morning is brought together a panel of people who have actual experience with work on the ground. And what we're hoping to do is to ask each of them briefly to describe their work on the ground and one big idea, and then open it up for our discussion so that we can test the potential. I'd like to start, if I may, with Mitchell Resnick. Mitchell is from the Media Lab. He is an associate professor there. He develops technological tools and has been particularly involved with the development of Lego Mindstorms robotics construction kit. He has also led the development of several projects designed to help people learn about complex systems and emergent phenomena. Mitchell, would you lead us off?
Thank you, Charlie. Actually, in Charlie's opening remarks, he talked about the great promise that accompanied television and radio as potential learning tools. And again, we really do see the computer being in a very different category. In fact, I sometimes ask people, which of these three things doesn't belong? The television, the computer, or finger paints? And most people say, well, you know, finger paints, of course, was the television and the computer. They're both inventions of the 20th century. They both have electronics. You know, they both can deliver information in ways that weren't possible before. But for me, the obvious answer is the television doesn't belong, because the computer, like finger paints, can be a new tool for creativity that lets people create things, to make things, to express themselves, which is not possible with the way people mostly would use the television. So the way we've tended to use the computer is as an expressive medium, to put it in the hands of people, to let them create things, express themselves, and learn through expressing themselves. And as we've developed new tools and new environments for using the computer, that's been our top priority. Let me give a specific story of a young person who came to one of the after-school learning centers that we set up here in Boston, a place called the Computer Clubhouse. And hopefully the technology will be working. And this was a young man named Mike. And in fact, when Mike first came to the clubhouse, he had dropped out of high school, and a friend told him about the clubhouse. He came there. He'd never used a computer before. But when he came, his passion was art. He was always making little drawings. In fact, he probably was unsuccessful in school because he was drawing in his notebook rather than paying attention. So when he came to the clubhouse, the first thing he did is he started drawing on paper, and he only used the computer to scan in the image he drew by hand and use the computer for coloring it. This is one of the first images he did. So he only used the computer for coloring it in. And that was the way he started to test this new medium. A little later, this was a drawing that he did where he started to use the computer to take advantage of some of the computer's capabilities somewhat more. of using the lettering around it and using sort of gradations with the color that wouldn't have been possible for him to do by hand. So for the first time, he was really taking greater advantage of things that weren't possible for him to do without the computer. As he started to do this, other of the young people around the clubhouse were very impressed with what he did and started to ask him for advice of how they could, you know, make similar drawings. In fact, this is a drawing that you can see is in somewhat the same spirit, was done by another of the young people there who had gotten advice from Mike about how to do it and started to draw in what became known as the Mike Lee style. And for the first time in Mike's life, other people were looking up to him. And in fact, some of his early drawings had used gang imagery of guns and knives. And all of a sudden, he told us, he said he wasn't going to do that anymore because he saw younger kids were copying his drawings and that this wasn't good, that they shouldn't be doing drawings like that. So for the first time, he sort of felt his role within the community that he hadn't felt before. His artwork, at least in our mind, became more and more rich and sophisticated. Here's a drawing they did where you see a montage of images they put together, and you can see there's a type of political statement in what he's doing, of having a person looking at the blank wall rather than the images that are so important to him. Through this work, Mike became greater, you know, developed more capabilities, you know, with the computer, actually ended up getting a high school equivalency degree on his own, and ultimately actually got a job through this and started working for a local company doing web page design. This is something he did for the company, doing web page design. But I think the important part in the story for me is not so much that he was able to get a job from it, although of course it's great that he was able to. I always like the John Dewey line where he said, the purpose of education is not just to learn how to make a living, but to learn how to make a life. And in my mind, what the computer enabled Mike to do was to learn how to make a life. And I think an important part of learning to make a life is learning to express yourself with the materials at hand. And I think that's where we see the computer as something that enables people to shape the world around them, to be able to express themselves, to become part of a larger community, as Mike did here. Whereas before he'd felt alienated from the surrounding culture, here he became feeling part of it. He knew the computer was an important part of the surrounding culture. For the first time, this made him feel part of it. He felt that other people were looking up to him. He felt that he could play a contributing role, not just economically, but in all types of other ways. So I think, you know, the main message I'd want to leave with is trying to use the computer not just as a new way to deliver information, although it can be great for that, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's possible to use that in productive ways, but it shouldn't be used only that way. I think the biggest transformative, the biggest transformations will come when the computer is used by people to follow up on their own interests, as Mike did with his art, although other people have other interests they follow up on, but to take their own interests, to follow up it, to allow them to express themselves in new ways, to become part of a larger community. Thanks.
Thank you, Mitchell. That was just great. Excellent. Next, Javier El Guaya from Telmex. He is someone who's been involved in leading his company in learning enterprises within the company that has had great effects in terms of relationships with company employees, and has also been involved in the company's efforts with respect to external, local educational programs. And welcome to Harvard Law School.
Thank you very much. There are, I would say, two new buzzwords, fashionable words, that we're using a lot. That one of them is new economy. The other one is digital divide. These buzzwords are real issues, I should say. The fact that they became fashionable does not does any demerit to them. But behind those two buzzwords, there's two concerns, important concerns for developing countries, which are still two-thirds of the population of the world. One is whether this new economy really exists, and there's a lot of discussion about it, and whether the increase in productivity that the information technology companies have observed in the past 10 years will disseminate to the rest of the economy. And the second one is whether this increase in productivity will create a gap between the haves and the have-nots of the digital technology. Those are real questions, in spite of the fact that this became buzzwords, fashionable, and there are a lot of resources now to do research on that. One of the conclusions of 30, 40 years of research on growth and development in the third world is that there are two most important factors. I'm not going to extend myself too much in promoting growth in underdeveloped societies. One is technology, the other one is education. Neither of these two is new in the beginning of this 21st century. There have been previous technological revolutions, the railway, the telegraph, which had some striking resemblance with internet, electricity, of course, and they promoted growth, not only in the developed countries where the innovations took place, but all over the world. And there's also, as Mitch was mentioning now, previous educational revolutions. Film and radio was perhaps the first of them. I remember Edison saying that teachers would be driven out of classrooms by films and radio because that would substitute basically what they were doing. The same or sort of the same thing happened with television, later on with computer and computer-based training. Now internet is the buzzword, and it is supposed to lead this new educational revolution. But the question that brings us all of us here is whether information technologies are related to growth and whether they are related in the third world, which is, again, the concern of two-thirds of the world's population. It is obvious now that as compared to other technologies like electricity, like railways, information technologies are expanding in the world at a faster rate. In the case of the third world, at double the rate of the first world countries. And that they have some promise of promoting productivity beyond, again, the information technology sector, which is the only one that it is nowadays obviously growing as a result of the selling of a lot of computers and servers and routers and things like that. It promises to deliver information, which is now even more valuable than it was before. It promises to provide third world companies and micro-sized companies with management tools that they did not have in the past. It promises to provide with access to global markets to most of those companies, even one-person companies in the third world. It promises to reduce its costs and get rid of intermediaries that are so expensive for the economic process. It promotes optimal size in the companies because a lot of the services can be outsourced now through internet. And most of all, probably the most important promise of this revolution in information technology is that it promotes, it promises to educate anyone, anywhere, in any subject, at any time they want. Not a simple thing. We at in Mexico, Telmex, understand that the development of the country and the rest of the Latin America depends on industrialization, supported basically by their own technology, if we are able to develop our own technology or our own technological solutions, should I say, to our own peculiar geographical, socioeconomic problems, and by adapting other digital technologies developed somewhere else to our own conditions. We understand also that investment in human development and human capital, social resources, is the cornerstone of this growing process, together with the introduction of technology. Providing most of the population with technological access, as well as education, and also the required knowledge, the skills to take actively part in this new era, if this new era is going to happen, is a mandatory fact to improve simultaneously the global competitiveness of our economies and the social equality within our own countries. We at Telmex, as it was mentioned, had, I would say, reasonable success in modernizing the company. The company is the largest private company in the country. It is, in a sense, I was saying yesterday, a sample of the country. That's its worst. It had its worst vices and its best virtues. And it was able to face competition from giants in the telecommunication business, such as AT&T and MCI. I'm not going to elaborate that. Later on has been degenerating into a competition among lawyers, not among technologies or among customers.
Let's hear it for that.
That's good for the lawyers, yes. We have reached a point, and this is my last conclusion, reached a point in which we have understood that philanthropy and the creation of the Telmex Foundation, which supports 10,000 students and has interconnected more than 5,000 schools in the country, is now merging with marketing. We have reached a point in which our markets are saturated. Those that have access to telephone lines and to internet lines all of them have already telephone lines or internet capacity. And there's a large segment of the population, we're 100, almost 100 million inhabitants country, that do not have access to that, although they might have the money to access and buy the necessary equipment to access internet, and with it, the digital area. We have about 10 million illiterate adults in Mexico, and about 40 million alphabetically, technologically illiterate adults also. Most of them do or would be able to have access to this technology. They would only have a way to finance and to acquire the proper skills. To do that, we created a partnership with the MIT, with the Media Labs, and created in Mexico the Center for Digital Culture, and at the Media Labs, the Telmex Lab, which had three level responsibilities. The first one is to promote innovation and the intelligent transfer of technology from the first world to the second world. We're basically training specialists on that. Some of them are here. The first generation started just a couple of months ago here at the MIT. And we expect them to be experts on the transfer of technology, or at least on deciding when and where we should try to develop our own solutions from scratch, and when and where we should try to adapt intelligently what other countries have done. The second tier is the massive part of the country, those that are under unfavorable conditions to access because they lack the economic resources to access internet or digital technology, or because they lack the skills. So we have developed a program to train and to provide professors, teachers and professors, 1 million teachers and professors, with the necessary equipment to do that and with the skills to use that at schools, together with the, as I mentioned before, connectivity that we are providing to schools. And third, we are doing research at this Center for Digital Culture, both at the Telmex Lab, in trying to create digital solutions to combat the extreme poverty and increasing the life quality of the poor population of this country and the rest of the countries in which Telmex is involved in the rest of Latin America. To conclude, I would say we have found through this effort that most companies in our case, not just telecoms, but software companies, and among them Cisco, Microsoft, Sun Systems, are facing the same problem. Either they invest in education, and enlarge markets considerably, and merge philanthropy with marketing research, or the growth in the third world is mostly over. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Javier. Next up is Robert Hawkins. He's manager of the World Links for Development Program, which is an initiative of the World Bank. It connects schools in developing countries to the internet, trains teachers to effectively integrate technology into their classrooms, and facilitates collaborative, project-based learning activities with other schools. Robert.
Thanks, Charles. Thanks so much for the organizers here. This has been an extremely exciting few days of exchanging knowledge and ideas, and all of us being teachers and learners, which is one of the philosophies of the World Links program. This is a program which started in the World Bank Institute, which is the training arm of the bank. It's a grant-based program. We're focused on partnerships, finding partners in the NGO sector and with other bilaterals, other donors. We're currently working in 18 countries with over 500 schools, reaching approximately 100,000 students. The overall objective is to create a global education network to connect schools to the internet, train teachers to effectively integrate the technology in their teaching and learning, and evaluate the entire process. For the World Bank, this program is somewhat of a large experimental research project in the sense that there's no real good data anywhere in the world on the impact of this type of intervention for teachers and students. Let me touch on a couple themes based on our experience in these countries over the past 3 years. The program started in 1997. The first theme I want to touch on is the idea of technological perseverance. If you can imagine the little glitches that we've experienced here at MIT and compound them by a hundredfold or a thousandfold, this is the daily reality that the teachers that we're working with are experiencing each day in the classroom with their schools. They deal with problems from power to power spikes to viruses to computers that break down to lack of technical support. The range of technological issues that they fight through on a daily basis is really astounding. But what's hopeful is that these teachers and students are continuing to work. We don't finance any of the recurrent costs for the program, and we haven't lost any school yet as a result of these problems. The students and the teachers and the parents and the headmasters find a way to keep things going. And the image that I often see, we've used this metaphor quite a bit this week, the metaphor of a fire hose. Many of these schools are in the desert with a huge fire hose hanging over them that's just dripping water. And their thirst for knowledge is so strong that it inspires me to be here to see what the possibilities are, and at the same time frustrates me to see that we're not realizing these possibilities. We need to figure out a way to get technology at a cheaper cost much more quickly into the hands of these schools and teachers. Another theme that I want to touch on is the idea of inspiring teachers to inspire students. Ultimately, this is what teachers should do. Their job should be to inspire. And we put a lot of emphasis on teacher training. We've developed five 40-hour modules that help teachers to think through how to use this technology in the classroom. A lot of countries that we work in have put the computers in the classroom and washed their hands of it and said, okay, we're done. This is somewhat equivalent of putting Mitchell in a NASA spaceship and asking him to fly it without any training. We need to work with the teachers to understand how to effectively use, I don't know, maybe Mitchell's good enough that he could fly it. I'm sorry.
I don't want to
be a little Mitchell here.
He can do it.
But we need to continue to train the teachers in effectively using this technology, not just the computer savvy teachers. What happens often is that the ministry or a school will put together a computer lab, and their idea of computer training is computer literacy. And they'll get a computer savvy teacher, and that'll be his or her domain. And the geography teacher, the biology teacher, the social studies teacher never gets access to the lab. And we need to distinguish between computer literacy and integration of use of technology in the classroom, and work with policymakers and headmasters to understand this difference, so that the technology can be used as a tool for all the teachers to access information, to share information, and ultimately to create information. Another theme I want to touch on is the power of this technology to spark hopes and dreams for students. And much of the work that I've seen here at the Media Lab, I think, is also getting at that. We have a marriage of philosophies. That the collaborative projects that we've been working with students on have truly sparked a voice, an identity, and a hope for the students we're working with. Students have a voice in the world through a project that MIT has, the student newspaper, the Nation One group. We're building on that basic belief of students that they can change the world, that they can do anything. And I think this should be reinforced. We have students in Uganda working on a refugee project, going out to the refugee camps, interviewing refugees, understanding their problem, sharing these experiences with other students around the world. We have students in Peru that have worked on a water project and have actually worked with the Ministry of Water, I guess, to get a slogan and a URL on each one of their bills that goes to all of their customers, trying to raise awareness to water quality and environmental issues. Identity is also a theme that has emerged through these collaborative projects. We're working with a group in Paraguay where the predominant language is Guarani. And suddenly, through collaboration with other students, they have an elevated awareness of who they are. They've begun to understand their own culture, their own history, their own background. And in exchanging these views with other students, there's this elevated sense of identity and pride, really. And at the same time, they're developing content in Guarani that's being shared with other students and teachers in their culture. And then finally, hope. We've done our monitoring evaluation study for 2 years now. This year we reached 500 respondents in 140 schools in 12 countries. And again, this year, the greatest perceived benefit of this program to students is employment. They want to work. And we hope that we're giving them the skills, the teamwork skills, the communication skills, the understanding of other cultures, the information reasoning skills that will indeed help them become active and engaged citizens in their communities. The last point I want to bring up is the impact that the program has had on shaking up the system and on some of the barriers that we've faced. The largest barrier to this type of pedagogy in the countries we've been working on is just simply time. Teachers are confined to a national curriculum and incentives that are driven by their national exam schedule. And they simply don't have time to pull their kids out of the classroom and experiment with new ways of teaching and learning. This is a huge issue, and we don't pretend to be able to solve this issue. But we hope that by introducing more and more teachers to a different type of pedagogy, we'll create a guerrilla force, so to speak, that will hopefully sooner than later affect real change in education reform. Another barrier is cost. We don't finance in the recurrent cost of this program, and internet time, telephone time, paper toner is still very expensive in much of these in all of these countries, really. And we need to find ways to work with the private sector, to find innovative ways to use the schools after hours to generate some recurrent costs for the communities to keep the program moving. There's a wonderful example in Chile where Telefónica has offered free access to all of the schools in Chile. We need to have more of those examples. Finally, which was brought up in the last panel, awareness raising. We need to continue to raise the awareness of policymakers as to the importance of educating their youth to participate in a global economy. When we started this program, even in the World Bank, we were met with many a dubious look. We were considered really crazy to be doing this. There are so many other priorities that many of the countries we're working in have. Why in the world would we try to introduce computers into the school system? But we kind of wore this as a badge of honor. I think there's real value to creative destruction, to doing things that are crazy. And perhaps development really is embracing craziness, embracing new ideas, embracing wackiness. And through connectivity, perhaps we can generate more of this. Let me just end on a riff that DJ Spooky started last night. And I think that the real hope and excitement that we have in working in this field is that there are so many new opportunities. There are so many opportunities to bring disparate people together to create something that hadn't existed before. So I would like to imagine that someday, as a result of this program, a crazy idea, you'd have a student in Bolivia adding his video riff to a collaborative project, a teacher in Japan adding animation, a minister in Ghana putting in a new scratch into a collaborative project that they're working on together, and perhaps DJ Spooky and Isaac Hayes will collaborate with them in an online concert. Perhaps Isaac would call this concert, "My Woman Has Left Me, I'm Feeling Low. But as long as I can do this with my brother in Bolivia, there's hope for us all." So that's my dream.
You know, you don't look like a wild and crazy guy.
For Isaac, it's a little bit better.
David Cavallo is a research scientist in the Epistemology and Learning Group at the Media Lab. He is a protege of Seymour Papert. I received his doctorate under him. He focuses on the design and implementation of new learning environments and educational systems at both micro and macro levels. He's done work in Thailand, Brazil, Mexico, Costa Rica, Colombia, and in a juvenile jail in the United States. Were you behind bars or in front of the bars? No.
Yes.
David.
Actually, Kun Poron Isorena was the one supposed to be on this panel today. He's coordinated our project in Thailand and unfortunately became ill last week and couldn't make this journey. He sent the text of what he was going to say to me, unfortunately sent it in Thai. And so I'm just going to focus on that one thing there in terms of that one project, although
I got to mention the juvenile jail project as being one of the most thrilling and exciting things, the most heartwarming things that I've worked on, and where we've seen incredible changes, but that's for another time. The background of the Thailand project, and actually it relates to something that Javier was also mentioning, is that around almost exactly 4 years ago, we first started discussions with people there where it was from a private-public partnership, but primarily from the private sector, whereas they were looking for Thai industry as with the WTO agreements, the trade opening up, that they felt that most of the Thai companies would not remain competitive going into the future unless there were severe changes in the educational system. You know, they had had some of the most spectacular growth of any country over the previous 10, 15 years, but they had it in low-wage, low-growth, low-skill sector, and they felt that not only wouldn't that be sustainable, but they felt those gains would be lost because they would be undercut because they're only competing on price. So they felt that they needed a very different educational system that could gear itself towards creativity, innovation, working in not just to follow on and do the assembly afterwards after an innovation from another place, but to be able to do those innovations themselves. And they looked at the depth and the history of their culture, and there was a belief of, well, why not? But what they also felt, and why they were talking to us, one reason was they felt that the role of technology was going to be huge, not just in terms of having to know it, but what it could open up in the possibilities of learning and learning in a different way. But also because they were worried that to change the existing school system, that the system itself was highly bureaucratic, extremely hierarchical, tremendous constraints, very difficult to change. And so we designed a project that would then look at in what way you could have really strong long-term effect across the board, but by doing this, by really trying to get out of the box, innovate, and create a wide variety of pilot alternative programs that would have the chance, the opportunity, and the support to go very deeply so that you could create some of these new learning environments that they were hoping for, and to use those as concrete examples in the Thai context as a way of promoting change. And so going some ways out of the system, although we always had the support and the collaboration of the education ministry, going out of the system as a way to improve the system. We focused initially on four pilot areas, one in terms of in the villages. Still most of Thailand's population is in rural areas. There's been tremendous problem by people moving from the rural areas to Bangkok, which caused destabilization in both of those places. And so the look at it is like, how could you improve the educational opportunities for children and adults in the village areas, as well as then what that could tie into in terms of economic opportunities down the road. Collaborating with that, we work with the non-formal education sector, as which also deals with most of the children that have either dropped out of school or in rural areas, or as well as with adult education. We wanted to use these things for teacher development. We felt, I mean, you look at most of the education schools everywhere, the United States included, we're training teachers for the schools of, I don't know, 50 years ago. The Ed School here at Harvard is a little bit moving ahead, but it's very still like backwards in the sense of what you can do for the teachers into this innovative, you know, environment we're trying to go in the future. The fourth pilot area was working with children at risk. Initially, this meant the children that spend most of their time on the streets in Bangkok, as well as a lot of the girls who were either in danger of being sold into or going into prostitution, or those that were coming out. The other thing that we tried to do from the beginning was create a group of what we call learning fellows, which would be a group of activist researchers that had enough connection into the establishment that they could research what was working, what was not, mentor the projects, but then also be the ones that would be able to help document it, research it, and then help things to actually change going forward. I want to give just two quick stories so we don't run over. But one is that on my first visit to Thailand, one of the non-formal schools, a lot of the non-formal schools are in the Buddhist temples. And so I went in there and they were showing me this one in particular because they actually had two computers there. And so they're doing a computer class for the children. And, you know, I missed the class, but I was seeing, and one of the kids was still there because he was having trouble with his homework. And so he was like absolutely mystified. The class was teaching them to memorize DOS commands. And this is 1997, right? But that was the class and that was the approach. Memorize DOS, learn DOS, then you can learn Windows, then maybe you can learn Microsoft Office, and in 5 years, you'll know stuff that doesn't exist anymore. Then, just out of time learning. So, the kid was having a problem, because the four commands he had to learn, the first was to do directory, right, to see what was there. The second was to copy one file from one directory to another. The third was to format the disk. Now, the fourth one I don't remember, because at that point he went through it once and it worked fine. Well, once he formatted his disk, all of a sudden when he did his directory command, well, there was nothing there. And he couldn't understand. He followed the teacher's homework exactly. He was doing exactly what was said to do, and he was really lost. And it took a while to explain this both to him and to the teacher. And I was kind of mystified. It's like, this is how they're teaching computers. We really have a lot of trouble. As I was leaving, now, if you go to any of the Buddhist temples in Thailand, the flowers, the gardens, they're just spectacular. I mean, it's the most beautiful thing you could see in the world. And so I asked, you know, one of the monks, you know, how do people learn? Who takes care of this? They said, well, the young monks. How do they learn? You know, so, you know, they said, well, when the new ones come in, they work with the older ones, they do it together, you know, and eventually they become good at it. And so I was working through a translator who was the English teacher for the school in that area, and I said, well, that's the approach that we like to take around computers. We think of a culture, you know, that, actually I asked one question before, and those who know me, I guess this will shock them, I was trying to be provocative. And I said, well, don't you teach it in the classroom like you do the computers? They said, well, we would never do that. Right? So I was saying, well, this is the way we try and approach learning computers, using it, being expressive, working in a culture, working with others. And then the response I got translated back was the monk said, well, we would never do that either. And I'm thinking, well, I was just saying we were doing what they were doing, so he couldn't be saying that. I said, well, what went wrong? And I asked, well, what did you say? And the teacher said, well, I told them that you were saying they should teach flower gardening in the classroom like they teach computers. And so this showed the mindset of the teacher, who couldn't believe that I might have said, don't do it in the classroom, do otherwise, but also the mindset of the just school, and that you go and this is how the best way to learn it is to do it in that way, when I was saying the exact opposite. Then actually, she stopped translating things because we had a great like half-hour discussion about how it could actually be possible, particularly for something like computers. So these were the type of environments that we tried to set up, where it's not just like using the classroom and then you do everything and there are all these prerequisites. I love cell phones. So, but really to just treat it as like you're working on real projects, things that you're interested in, that you can learn it in a culture, and to use more formal instruction in a different way, not just where it's the majority of things that you do, where it's like what Bob was talking about, and then maybe you can find time to do something that you can really show are really interesting, but to really turn the balance of that equation around. So in one of the villages that we spent a lot of time, we did exactly that, where we didn't only work with the children, but as we got started, we worked with everybody, and we invited all the people from the village to start to look at what was important in their lives. You know, what were the issues that they had? What were the things that they'd like to see? What would they like to improve? And we made working on these projects the work of our learning environment. And so in this area, you know, it was a very dry area, but in other areas, it depended on the area, and this was good. We worked on the projects around the things that people were interested in, as well as also just letting children play, building animations, working with robotics at the same time, but where then you saw there was a real synergy between these two kinds of things. What we saw was that this became, as people worked on in order to rethink an irrigation system, to build a dam, to look at how they were growing agriculture, to become what they call their soil doctors, to look at how you could do that, that, you know, there's a lot of math, the science, all the things that we want to teach in our curricula, that they had to do this. Because in the other way, well, why is something in a curriculum? It's there because it's important to use in life, allegedly. So then it's like, well, if you're doing the projects that are there in life, these issues that are in the curricula are going to come up, but they're going to come up in a very contextualized way. The other thing that we saw that we were able to do is that we were able to build on local culture, ways of knowing, ways of expression, because we're using the technology and the learning environment in general as an expressive and as a productive, constructive kind of means. Now, and since I'm in a law school, I feel like there should be truth in advertising. Obviously, not everything went well. I mean, there are the pluses. One was that there was severe doubt when we began about the capabilities of students, and particularly the capabilities of teacher, and I know with Clotilda, they had the same experience. People told us before we started, the teachers in the rural areas in particular, but in most of the schools, are poorly educated themselves. Some of them have only had sixth grade education. They're not going to be able to learn the technology, let alone try and work in a different learning environment. And that was patently false. We really saw the capabilities of these teachers when they were supported and when they were given opportunity to be just tremendous. And particularly the ones when they lived in the community and shared those concerns, it was a great, they felt liberated actually to work in a different kind of way. Likewise, the capabilities of the students. Where we do feel there was good effect is Thailand passed a new national education law. A lot of really good things were in it, and it really did promote a different type of learning environment. They really are a lot of concrete alternatives to learning environments that are in existence there. Now, where I felt that we lost One was on just consistency. I mean, education ministries around the world, a lot of it is just for anti-corruption, but they transfer people constantly. You get this person you hope, maybe you have them 6 months, maybe 1 year, sometimes it's maximum 2 years. It's hard to do any project when you're kind of, the time is cut for so quickly. Before we started, we wanted the teachers to have 6 weeks of development time and 6 weeks of their own time to work with technology, work on projects of their own, to think through, to build their own capabilities. And always and everywhere that we go, we propose this, and nowhere do we go do they actually do this, is to give the teachers the time to do this because they say it costs too much. So there's a view of a short-term cost that, you know, people say we can't afford that, that has a long-term incredibly bad effect. So this initial expense, yes, it's an expense, but it's absolutely worthwhile because you pay for it later down the line in terms of not giving the teachers the time to develop. And I guess the last thing is that when we did propose this Learning Fellows program, that also didn't really get implemented. And so we have a lot of good examples of things, but the spread and the sharing and the growth of these ideas and these practices has been far more limited than what we would have hoped. It has grown, and we have gone into new areas, but that's been severely limited by not having this group or some type of group that would be able to build from these lessons and apply them elsewhere. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Ms. Clotilda Fonseca is founding director of the Costa Rican Computers in Education Program. It was created in 1988, and she's been associated with it fundamentally ever since.
I imagine you have noticed that in most of these panels, the younger people have been placed at the end to contribute. And I am quite sure that there was a lot of thinking in this because I can define myself as the adolescent in this group. I have been working with technology and education for 13 years. And that means I'm getting into my adolescent years. And of course, as a result of that, I'm becoming somewhat rebellious and somewhat indisciplined and with a great urgency to express many of the things I have seen in all of these years, not only in my program in Costa Rica, but also in the international arena. So even though I was requested to speak about the Costa Rican experience, and I hope I'll have a chance to do that, I feel this urgency to talk about some issues that I think have to be addressed in a conference like this on e-development, because we have to see the two points, the e and the development. And I would like to start by referring to a very powerful and thought-provoking statement by one of the great German philosophers of last century who said, that the only thing that man learns about history is that man learns nothing about history. And I think that in the case of computers in education, this is certainly the case. We have been through different revolutions, and every time it seems like we have to begin addressing some of the central concerns. And for this reason, I would like to begin by quoting a quite fascinating statement by a finance minister from a Latin American country that visited Costa Rica some years ago and told me, "Oh my God, I have to confess I love your project. It really makes substantive contribution. It installs computers, the children learn, you do away with teachers, you reduce the state payroll, and the best of all, you eliminate strikes, a perfect case of governmental reengineering." It was a difficult thing to have to convince him that it was not like that. And for this reason, I want to bring about today the great dangers of thoughtless solutions to the introduction of computers in education. Because most nations, most agencies, and most financial institutions are pushing a fast food approach to computers for learning. And we have to beware of this fast food metaphor that not only does not understand the tremendous potential of this emerging culture of the digital world, but tries to reduce that potential to educational learning paradigms of the 19th century, not even the 20th century. So we really, those of us who have been around the Media Lab and worked with Seymour and Mitch and David and all the group there, even though there has been so much knowledge around, there has been very little action. For this, I would like to address the myths that I see as the most difficult myths that people in the developing world have to deal with when they are confronted with the powerful urge to generate programs in this area. The first one of them is the linear view of development. People think that you have to go through different stages, as if development were a staircase, that you have to go through all of these stages. And they really miss the capacity of the new technology to leapfrog and generate fundamental changes. But this is the prevalent view in many institutions, even though they pay a lot of lip service to connectivity and digital revolution. When poor countries try to address these issues, they have to confront internally and externally issues or arguments saying that this is too costly, that it is the cost effectiveness is uncertain, and besides that there is no hard evidence about impact. And this is a double language because rich countries, developed countries, do not have to justify investing in the digital revolution. The poor countries have, and this is a serious concern to many of us who see technology as a very powerful activator of social, economic, and educational development. The second myth is the innovation myth, and we have to pay good attention to this. The mere presence of computers does not guarantee change. I want to emphasize this. Computers become a novelty in a school, but they do not necessarily generate innovation in learning unless there is an accompaniment of a fundamental vision, which is social, pedagogical, and economic. We are confronted permanently with what I call technological reductionism. We are transforming our schools by putting computers in to do more than what we were already doing very poorly, to do instruction, not to generate new empowering environments for learning. And this is a great danger. The other is the computer literacy myth. I don't think I'm going to pay a lot of attention to this one because it has somehow been touched on during the different discussions. We keep dragging a concept from the Gutenberg paradigm, but what does it mean to be computer literacy today? Are we to teach computing as if we were to say some years back that we should teach pencil and teach pencil one, pencil two, and pencil three? Is that the metaphor we want to use? We need to focus on fluency and capacity to adapt to the changes in the emerging culture. The other is the myth of access. There's not a word that is more used when you talk about the digital divide of computers than access. Access is certainly more than contact with a computer as an object and the internet as a highway. Access builds on basic literacy, cognitive capabilities, and organizational skills. And this we have to give a lot of thought to. There was a very interesting article in The Economist about a month ago talking about what the internet cannot do. And this is crucial for development. We do have to develop the potential of the individuals to make use of the technology. And this leads to another very serious question and very interesting question. Most countries in the developing world are using focalization policies, which are politically correct, and political really have a lot of payoff. They are putting computing in telecenters for people to come and play around with different solutions. I am not against telecenters. I think they are a wonderful option for community. But if we are really going to bridge the divide, that, as was said earlier, is a social divide. It's a cognitive divide. It's a learning divide. We have to pay attention to universalization policies. We cannot do this without the school system, no matter how perverse, negative, underdeveloped it is. And we have to pay attention to this. And the world discussion is not addressing this. I was in Malaysia at the Global Knowledge Forum at the beginning of the year. And it seemed to me like schools had disappeared. I was wondering if this was a new revolution, that we were de-schooling learning in a significant way. But no, they're there. And I think that we have to pay attention to them. The other is the connectivity myth. We discussed this in great detail this morning. But connectivity is a necessary condition to create new learning environments, but it is not enough. And I am extremely concerned about the naive view, simplistic view, amazingly simplistic view that financial organizations and many organizations around the world in charge of promoting these technologies are talking about these issues. The internet is fantastic. It's powerful. It's the greatest revolution of the recent times. But it will not connectivity, connecting schools to the internet, will not do away with poverty and ignorance. And we are speaking as if it will. Much work has to go into this for connectivity and internet to make a significant impact on poverty and ignorance. And I want to be provocative and open the discussion to this later. Internet can be seen as a hydrant, as Franklin Chan, a Costa Rican scientist at NASA, has said. It is a powerful source that can be useless if you are just thirsty and need to drink. It can really drown you if you don't have the critical skills, the searching skills to make use of that powerful resource and to distinguish what information is valuable, what information is pertinent, and what information is also false, which leads to the issue of how we're going to validate information in this wonderful resource. The final one I want to address, which I'm very, very concerned about, is the information as knowledge myth. Everybody talks about putting children and putting teachers in contact with information as if information could be synthesized internally into knowledge. Understanding and critical thinking are central to the individual and collective construction of knowledge. Beware of the information overload. Because the information is there, it doesn't mean that people understand it or have made it significant for their lives. And this is another central issue. I just want to make a few final reflections. I know that time is short, and I don't want to be too indisciplined and rebellious in terms of the format of the discussion here. But one thing when we deal with technology and development is the importance of long-term view. There are no express solutions for the type of educational and learning paradigm we need to construct. We have to transcend the simplistic views. Projects must be based on vision, on planning, and commitment. Serious investments have to be made in human capacity building, research, and follow-up. Access has to be meaningful, not only personally and socially meaningful, but it also has to be meaningful in terms of time. You have to have enough contact with the technology to become really an expert in its use and to make significant use. It also needs substantial political and financial support. Costa Rica started an effort 13 years ago, and we've been working with the Media Lab, as I mentioned, ever since, and many of our inspiring activities on ground are based on our discussions with our colleagues from the Media Lab, from the Learning and Epistemology group there. We have 12 years experience. In these 12 years, we have conducted one of the more massive, I don't like the term massive, but perhaps it's one we can use for the moment, experiences in the introduction of computers to kids in underdeveloped countries. We are working with rural and marginal urban kids. And in this first decade, we have serviced over 1 million children and teachers in the country, which is a significant accomplishment for a country with around, as Eleonora said, that believes has 4 million inhabitants. Some of the central characteristics, and I do want to make a brief reference to this model, had to do with the fact that we work with the younger children. We started from the beginning with children in preschool and moved on to sixth, and the country has moved also to the high school. But we wanted a new generation of children, not only who had contact with the computer as an object, but who had contact with this emerging culture. We made the teacher a core of the program. We made the teacher an allied. Not unlike the finance minister, we did not say teachers are dumb, let's get out of the payroll and just resolve. We have had the computer as a tool for learning, not as a tool for instruction. We have strong teacher development and follow-up, a long-term view and commitment and priority to marginal and urban areas with an interest in creativity and cognition. We focus on a project-based approach, learning by doing, learning from mistakes, addressing thinking skills and creativity, the importance of collaboration and teamwork, which is something the country has had difficulty dealing with, an emphasis in productivity. I would like to close by saying that our experience shows that children, teachers, and principals in the developing world have the capacity to learn and profit from the digital world. This is one of the more powerful lessons that Costa Rica can pass on to other countries that are beginning. It is possible. Learning to use technology, of course, and it was said earlier, is easy, relatively easy. Changing the educational culture into a learning culture is also possible, but it takes a lot of time and effort, and that's the more difficult component. I won't talk about the achievements, perhaps we'll do that in the part of the questions, but these achievements are not the result of the presence of technology. They are the result of its use within a certain epistemological and social vision. They are based on decisions that are pedagogical, political, and economic. Bernard Shaw said that at the age of 5, he was forced to abandon his education in order to attend school. This is true for many children in the developing world. But I would like to close with a very powerful statement by a Costa Rican principal from one of the poorest regions in the country. He said when he decided to invest the money he had for a soccer field into preparing the infrastructure for the computer lab, what these children really learn are soccer fields for the mind. And it is this emphasis in mind where we have been working and where I think we have to work to make connectivity, internet, and computers meaningful. Thank you.
All right, now I'd like to move directly to questions and interactions with the audience. I'd like to invite you to come to the microphone, if you would. Perhaps while people are making their way to the microphone, can I just ask the panel, do you all agree with Clotilde that schools are the necessary focus of a learning strategy of e-development? Is that something that's uniform across the panel?
I'd say one focus. I'd say the focus is one focus in my mind.
I get Willie Sutton said, when asked, why do you rob banks? That's where the money is. So, schools are where the children are. But I think I find myself agreeing with Clotilde. One specification, school as we think about it, is something I think, and this is where we agree, but it's what we need to think about how to move it forward and what that would be. And it may look very different from the school of now.
I would agree in the short term we need to work with the existing structure, but I don't think we should be limited by that structure. I think we should be creative in thinking in ways in which to think of teachers differently, think of mentors differently, think of real life experiences for students differently, getting them outside of the classroom, either physically or virtually, to learn about the world.
I mean, I think one thing we'd all agree on, that any strategy that ignores schools is
that's
a failure.
That's my point.
I think that we tend to forget that one of the most important revolutions in education, and it took several hundred years to develop, was a classroom. Chalk and board and a professor, and have a draw students going through drills. I mean, that was very important. The last 500 years of humankind education has gone through that. So I don't think we can do without it.
All right, let's go to the mics, and I realize, actually, as I think about it, that let's take these two questions, and then I'll just have people in their seats, and we'll get the mics to you, because this can be a tough room, actually, to move around, so take off.
I just want to start quickly by introducing myself. I'm an 18-year-old from Malaysia. I've just been here for a month for education at Swarthmore, and I've been at Global Knowledge, too. I was at the Youth Advisory Council, and I totally agree with every single thing you said. If I was asked to be on the panel, I'd say exactly the same thing. Now, I come from a country that does not have the privilege of giving computers to every school. The way my school has computers is that we win them through competitions. They didn't fall from the sky. And I think that is so interesting because you basically said that, you know, what if we get computers? What are we going to use to do them? Like, using computers to type out a report or to use it to search for information is something very different from the ability to work with other people from around the world. Our school took part in a competition called the AT&T Virtual Classroom, in which we partnered with three other schools. For us, what we did was, learning about Japanese culture was in fact a video conference with the Japanese school who played Japanese music for us. Learning about photography and digital imaging was about taking three separate photographs taken at three different locations, Penang, Japan, and the US, and merging them together so that we seem to be at the same place. So these things are happening, and basically what I'm saying is that maybe technology and money is important, but also the vision and the commitment of people to take advantage of these kind of opportunities. So I definitely agree with you, and I think that if we want this to happen, it's more than just having the technology, the computers, it's about having people who are really into this, who can see how technology can change the way we learn, more just than using it for typing or for searching information, but these kind of ways that can new approaches of learning, and I think that is really very important. But unfortunately, it is through my experience that there are very few people who think like we do. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Let's introduce yourself, too. I think that is a great idea.
I'm Pete Knight, Knight Moore Telematics for Education Development. I'm an economist with a second career in digital learning, I guess you might say. And so I have a question which has to do with the politics and economics, because technology is not the problem, folks. The technology is there. Money comes also to where the ideas are good and the strategies are focused. So I really want to ask the panel, what are the main lessons they've gotten in experience and implementation on building strategic alliances that assure the funding and the regulatory climate and the organizational support necessary to make these things happen? I like to think I had a small role in the Development of the World program, because something from my catalytic website in the World Bank was given to the president of the World Bank and says, your staff say you can do this, now just go out and do it, please. I say, let's just do it. But when it comes to the politics of this, it's much more difficult. So I was just in Zimbabwe, I saw world schools in Zimbabwe. I was in Peru. I saw world schools in Peru. How can they build alliances? I see, for instance, a university in Zimbabwe with no connectivity now could build an alliance with the world schools and use their training facilities and then later get them much better connectivity. What kinds of alliances have you seen on the ground that work to get the funding and some political support necessary to go beyond replicate, you know, a single school or a small group of schools to whole systems?
Great, thanks. Good question.
Are we answering or?
Yes, please. Nice practical question.
let me take a stab at that, Peter. First of all, on the economics, on the demand side, there's clearly demand for this type of opportunity for students. As I said, we don't finance any of the recurrent costs. None of the schools have dropped out of the program because of a lack of paying the recurrent costs, and they're substantial. In a place like Uganda, they're paying $200 a month. In Peru, it's a little bit less, around 150. But the parents see this as an opportunity for their kids to get a leg up, and they're paying for it. In terms of new partnerships, I think we need to do a lot more work in exploiting private-public sector partnerships. The private sector is the ultimate downstream beneficiary of, or one of the main downstream beneficiaries of the skills and the knowledge that the students are acquiring through these types of programs. And Chile is an excellent example of where Telefónica got together with the Ministry of Education, saw that this was their future client base, saw that they had a huge market in the school system, and if they could get to the kids, perhaps they could get to the parents to build their user base, and have offered free access for all of the schools.
Javier, do you have an insight in this question as well?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes, I think that we should stress, I mean, following Clotilde's remarks, that there's a very important coordination between government, research and educational institutions and private companies in order to accomplish this. And I think that the examples of this coordination are very scant. There are very few of them. My country is not one of them, certainly. Governments tend to try to attract investment and invite a lot of foreign transnational companies into the telecom or IT markets. And they tend to forget what Clotilde just told us. For example, Mexico City has been wired now to accommodate about three times the size of the city, when as a matter of fact, you would have to use smoke signals in Chiapas to communicate with Mexico City. So some of that policies are absurd. They try to attract investment, they try to promote competition among telecoms, but they completely forget about education. And as Clotilde made very clear, if you don't provide the skills, those wires will be absolutely useless. Again, the coordination between private sector, educational institutions, both for innovation and dissemination, and intelligent regulators is very important, but it is still the exception, not the rule.
Mitchell, to you, and then we'll take another question.
Okay. Clearly, this type of collaboration with government and private industry are very important, but I want to stress another type of partnership. In the Clubhouse project that I mentioned, it's been funded primarily from private sources and from industry and from government grants, but I think the most important partnership it has is with local community, and I think that's not looked at enough in a lot of educational initiatives, where a lot of the people, there's a whole range of community of volunteer mentors who come in and work with the young people. I think schools have never done enough to try to leverage the different capabilities from the surrounding community, and I think that's a place where types of partnerships which isn't the ones that are going to bring in the dollars, but bring in a type of strength to these initiatives that is really critical.
Great. Sir?
Hi, my name is Kweku Bwedu. I'm a technology practitioner in Ghana. I'd like to draw the panel's attention, get us focused on a few issues on the ground in Ghana. For instance, the first question is, at what point are we going to stop trying to get countries to get digitally literate? There are several countries in Africa that are very poor, and no matter what we tell them, they're still going to come up with excuses and reasons why they don't think they should be able to join the world in going digital.
Wait, one question to a customer here. Make it a good question.
Okay. Are we going to go some point and stop? Are we going to leave some countries behind? Take for instance, when we had electricity and say telephones, if we had tackled it with such a zeal, we probably would have had less problems today. So what effort are we going to put in to make sure that as many countries as possible get digitally integrated into the rest of the world?
Yeah, well, that's a big one, isn't it?
Well, let me raise some of the issues that are on the ground. some of the issues include some disparate efforts that I see on the ground. Like there's a UNESCO project, for instance, in Ghana that asks our company to interlink the universities. And they provided funding to buy two computers for each university. And the university has 6,000 students. So what's going to be the impact of this? Other issues have to do with funding. My company, for instance, has managed to convince a company next door, Nashua, to take equity shares in the company and bring in capital equipment. There's another company in the Czech Republic that is bringing in equipment to install wireless base stations. But then the subscriber cost in providing wireless access to a community is so high that even though these companies have been generous enough to bring in base stations, you still cannot connect these communities. How are we going to coordinate these activities of the World Bank and the IMF and UNESCO to make sure that monies that they have available are channeled to get these communities connected, because part of the cost has been taken care of already. But then this is a private organization which has nothing to do with the government. The government is not interested because I mean, if you're talking to a government official, I mean, or a public official, there's a politics component of this. What's in it for this government official? So government is not interested. How is UNESCO or how is the World Bank able to identify such organizations and be able to make sure that the investment that has already been put into the country can be utilized for the benefit of the community?
So I want to give others a chance at the microphone, but your question is clearly of immense importance. It really goes to the access issue. David, you want to take over?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's a huge issue. I think from here and from, let's say, a personal point of view, there's certain things that I don't believe that's in our place to impose on any other place. That said, with my colleague in the front, Maya Carlson, who's from here at Harvard, looking where she's raised the issue in terms of looking at the problems that are coming up from AIDS orphans in sub-Saharan Africa in particular, as well as other places, and where we're looking to hope to do a project in Tanzania in particular is a really important place to get started, where, going to your point, government resources are stretched so thin, or there's lack of will in some quarters perhaps, you can't expect where it's going to get funded, and you don't, let's say, have like the Telmex of the country who's willing to devote their resources to address these kind of internal social problems. So one of the first things that I believe is really important is just loud public pressure on the international organizations, not just to provide that, but help to make it effective and not just to be a conduit towards inefficiency or corruption. Public pressure in the sense of the need and all of that, where all the voices, as well as then the way that what we're trying to do is bring partnerships from outside that devote resources, collaborate with people that are there, that are doing, because there are a lot of tremendous innovative grassroots efforts that people are already doing where what they do doesn't get out and they don't get support. So those are some of the things, although that's not obviously a complete answer.
Great, thanks. Sir?
1 minute or less, I promise. Gabriel Kashner from UNDP. I just want to flag up a project that we have on the ground today and also ask the panelists if they have similar experiences with that. The project that we implemented in Malaysia is called the Mobile Internet Unit, and it's a bus with about 20 computers on. It's an innovative environment, if you want to call it that way, which goes from one rural school to another and stops about 2 weeks in each courtyard and trains students and teachers on mainly three things: productivity applications, internet type of application. Now there is a little KU band dish on the roof, and also as a classroom curriculum built into the system. We run this for 14 months now. So after 1 year, we kind of took some data out, and it's quite interesting because it flags up potential talent that you have in remote schools. The Ministry of Education today has funded 10 additional buses, and the University of Malaysia at Sarawak, a mobile internet boat, which goes up the river in Sarawak. There are no roads there, and does a little bit the same thing. I was just curious if anybody has similar experience, because it seems to be a very cost-effective way to reach schools that otherwise wouldn't be exposed to any of those environments for probably a number of years. Thank you.
That's
sure.
Fantastic.
Let me take a stab at that. In Zimbabwe, we're experimenting with a mobile van with computers that is driving around to the rural areas, and it was inaugurated this summer. I haven't seen it or gotten any real data back, but Peter has, so maybe he can comment on how it's doing.
I mean, just to throw in a bit of skepticism, though, I don't know anything about the projects. I'm hesitant to say this, but something that focuses on exposure is a word that worries me somewhat, because I really think that, you know, what we're looking for is a type of depth of experience and where the real, you know, value that comes in transforming the way that young people and adults will think about the world is through being able to make use of something in ever richer and deeper ways, or just an exposure to what something is. And again, I don't know about this particular program, but I think in general we should be careful not to think in just in terms of exposure.
But the suggestion was that there was an advantage in this program in identifying talent, which in some ways suggests a follow-on program.
I'd want to look carefully what it means identifying talent.
Yes.
You know, does talent mean someone who is sort of, quote, good at computers? I mean, the idea is to use the technology that everyone, in fact, the ones that have been least successful traditionally, and maybe are least successful on first exposure, might be the ones that can benefit most. So I'd want to be very careful with how we think about identifying talent.
So you're not in favor of any kind of sorting arrangement where you educate the elites. You want to make sure it stays spread.
I'd want to be very careful about things that are going to put extra resources specifically towards the elite. Again, I don't have any problem of, you know, giving everyone their own opportunities, and people that can go more deeply in some areas should be given that opportunity, but one has to be careful.
Fratelli, you had a...
Yes, I just wanted to say that there has to be a combination of strategies. I'm not all for do it only in the school. As a matter of fact, today we're confronting a de-schooling of learning, which is something that has to be addressed. But there has to be a combination between focalized experiences and universal experiences. And I want to bring up a very controversial issue here, and it has to do with military spending. I have checked, you know, the cost of an F-16 airplane, combat airplane, that are very popular in Latin America, and especially in Central America. And with one of them, you could provide computers to the majority of the schools. And with the maintenance of one of them, which is around $1 million per plane, and many of the countries have many, you could run those programs. So when we talk about lack of funding, it's really a very political issue, because it means defining priorities, and countries do have to define their priorities.
Great. Ma'am.
Thank you. My name is Eleonora Badilla. I'm a teacher from Costa Rica. And as I was listening to Robert, you were saying that some of the obstacles you've had in implementing this program in Latin America is the lack of flexibility of the national curriculum and the standardized tests. But those are precisely the conditions that the finance institutions like the World Bank are demanding from us in order to give us help for our educational projects. So I have a request for you. Would you please convince your economists at the World Bank that we need them to be more flexible on the conditions and the demands, that when they are going to evaluate our programs, our projects that we have with them, we want a more qualitative evaluation, and that we want to be part of digital nations, so they should help us to be part of the consortium. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, it's 12:15. Let's take two more, but please make them brief and short, and then we'll take our break.
Go. Thanks, I'll be brief. I'm Barry Joseph. I'm the Internet and Human Rights Coordinator at a Global Kids, a New York City-based educational organization. And I want to specifically ask a question about content, more to the point, education on the Internet. The last speaker said, I think very very accurately, that access to information is not the same as access to knowledge. And when I look online, I see that very clearly, because it's all about just educational content to be consumed, not as something, say, learning as something you play with or work with. And I wanted to ask if anyone on the panel could talk about how we can look to get the type of, what kind of thinking we need to see in the creation of online educational content that's more along the kind of pedagogy that I've been hearing advocated for in the classroom.
Good question.
I think I'd quibble, though, in terms of, like, your push for online content. You know, I think that's part of the problem. And even with the thing of technology is easy, I think goes back to Clotilda's point, is that, you know, the deeper part of the learning experience, when we say, oh, the technology is easy, we're saying technology in such a broad sense, we're only talking connectivity or a PC and not what you do with it. And given what you can do online, I think that still kind of takes the focus away from a lot of other things where I think there is certainly not the body that there should be, but there is a good body of things that you can do with the technology that provides for very strong and powerful learning environments, not necessarily online. You know, so, and I think that's probably where I would put the focus, as opposed to thinking, oh, what can we do better online and what content should we put there? What type of activity can we do around the technology?
Last question.
I'm Jan Visser, Learning Development Institute. There are two things I think that we should become more serious about. One is learning, the other one is development. The preconceptions that we have about those two concepts are very limited. We've been doing research on how people perceive their learning by collecting their learning stories. It's not surprising is that what comes out of it is that for most people, what they see as their most meaningful learning experiences are at best marginally related to the school system. The conclusion that one can draw from it is that if we are to successfully exploit the potential of the technologies that we have, we should certainly not neglect the school system, but we should place the school system in the context of the larger learning ecology and attend to the learning conditions wherever they are. I've heard some very interesting experiences from behind the table. The Lighthouse Project particularly, I think, is a very encouraging one. The clubhouses, there's a certain bias, I would say, among the five panelists towards the school system. I'd like to see that better developed. Then on the issue of development, Clotilde made the remark about the F-16. I agree. This is not only an issue for the developing countries, it's also an issue for the so-called developed countries, probably even more because the military spending there is more. Also, we need to redefine that concept in general. It does not just apply to those who consider themselves developed and who want to develop the others. We all are in need of development. Thank you very much.
Great. Well, let's treat that as a benediction on this proceeding, and let me ask you to give a round of applause to our audience, our panel. And let me turn the microphone over to Meg Smith, who has some meaningful announcements to make.
I have three quick announcements. I'm sure you're all very hungry, but luckily one of them is about lunch. First of all, if you have found a cell phone, if you could turn it in to the registration desk downstairs, it would be very much appreciated by the person who lost it. Second of all, I've been asked repeatedly about yesterday's content and today's content. It will be in an archive online. If you registered for the conference, you will receive an email about it that will tell you where to find it. We will also put the URL for the breakout session notes up on a screen that you'll see when you get back from lunch. If you did not register for the conference and you would like to receive the email, please sign up downstairs at the registration desk. And last but not least, lunch. We'd like to invite you all to the Ropes Gray Room in Pound Hall for box lunches. If you received a conference packet yesterday, there is a map inside. Otherwise, you can follow the stream. You can ask the Berkman folks or the CID folks if they know where Pound Hall is and how to get there. There are also some other options for lunch that we put signs up about in case you would prefer not to eat with Harvard Catering. So you can look on the walls downstairs for those options, but we hope to see you in Ropes Gray. Thanks.
Thank you. Should have. Yes. How interesting.